Call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order. We do have a quorum present. First item on the agenda, members, is approval of the March 27th, 2024 minutes. May I have a motion for to approve the minutes for March 27th?
So moved.
Representative Cleburne moves approval of the minutes for March 27th, 2024. Members, any discussion to that motion? All right, hearing none. Oops. Those in favor. Why do I keep doing this? I'm too excited. Sorry. So excited to get on with the business of the day. Any discussion? None. Hearing none. Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 27th, 2024 are adopted. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one, before we get started today, I have a procedural question on one of the bills that's going to be before us. It's number two, House File 4587, the Bierman Bill. It has nothing to do with the subject matter. As a matter of fact, I think we're supportive of the subject matter, but it was originally referred to the Transportation Committee, and then it was re-referred on the House floor back to Commerce. And I noticed in reviewing the bills for the floor tomorrow, then the transportation bill, this bill that we're hearing today has been included in that bill, but it's completely within the jurisdiction of this committee, and was wondering if maybe the chair could explain maybe for the committee as to what happened and why it's not in our policy bill, but it's in their policy bill and the like. That's just, again, housekeeping in process.
Certainly.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative O'Driscoll, appreciate the question. And I agree with you that this bill is within the jurisdiction of the Commerce Committee, which is why we are giving it a hearing today. As you noted, it has been included in a bill coming out of the Transportation Policy Committee, or the Transportation Committee and their policy bill. And while certainly it's true that this is an insurance issue, it has a nexus to transportation-related issues. So I understand why that committee took an interest in the bill. And my understanding is that the stakeholder work done to get the bill in a place where it enjoys, as you pointed out, broad support without controversy was done by members of that committee, sort of in that committee's orbit. So while this is an insurance issue, and that's why we're hearing it here in the Commerce Committee, which is important, it makes sense for it to continue in the Transportation Committee because that's where the work was kind of done, at least by members on that committee.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Just a follow-up, Madam Chair. The fact that this isn't controversial is no harm, no foul.
Yeah.
But I get very concerned when these kinds of things could happen on something that's controversial, where the Committee of Jurisdiction doesn't see it, but 24 hours before it comes up on the floor in another bill where we have jurisdiction. So just wanted to duly note for the record that something that we need to be a little tighter on, and maybe next year we'll be in a better spot to do that.
All right. Thank you. Members, first on the agenda for today is House File 2000. We are having an informational discussion on this bill today. No official action will be taken. Chair Stevenson, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House File 2000 is the bill to legalize sports betting in Minnesota. Just as a brief reminder, this committee heard this bill last year and voted it out of committee. It's visited several other committees. Since then, it's currently in the possession of the Tax Committee, but last week in Chair Cleburne's State Government Committee, we adopted a significant amendment, and in discussions with Representative O'Driscoll, we decided it'd be good to have a sort of informational hearing in this committee so that I could update members on that significant amendment and answer any questions, address any concerns that members have about what was done to the bill in the State Government Committee. This bill originated in the Commerce Committee. So members do have a memorandum from House Research in your packets outlining the changes in detail. I will highlight the significant changes, and then I'd be pleased to answer questions. We did increase the fees on a number of the operators. These fee increases are on the companies like, I mean, the example would be companies like DraftKings and FanDuel that we would expect would contract with the license holders to deliver sports betting. And we looked at other states' fee structures and discovered that we were a significant outlier in the fee structure that we were proposing, and so we modified the fees accordingly. One very significant change to the bill is that we incorporated daily fantasy sports into the bill. Previously was not in the bill at all. What happened there it was in at least one other state that legalized sports betting, the regulator of sports betting took the position that Daily Fantasy Sports was unlicensed, unauthorized sports betting and attempted to stamp out that activity, which I think is currently best described as a gray market activity. It's not expressly sanctioned by Minnesota law, not expressly prohibited by Minnesota law, generally tolerated. So this activity is occurring in Minnesota now. We are proposing to regulate it and tax it and make clear that it's lawful. And we are doing that with industry support. In fact, the reason why it's in the bill is that the people who do this came to us and said they would like to be included in the bill. We made some changes to the tax. We increased the tax on sports betting from 10 to 20%, and we added promotional bets back into the tax base. We did that in order to fund additional things out of the taxes, most significantly tax cuts for charitable gambling organizations. So we've had a lot of conversations about charitable gaming over the years, and members may have seen that an agreement was reached with the charities to resolve those issues, and a piece of that resolution is an agreement to support cutting taxes as delineated in this bill. So it's at maturity, it's a $40 million annual tax cut for the charities. And just to remind members, charitable gambling in Minnesota right now, the tax rate is high enough that actually the primary beneficiary of charitable gambling in Minnesota is the state of Minnesota. The second biggest beneficiary are the developers, and the actual charities are only the third biggest beneficiary. And the net impact of these tax cuts, coupled with some of the things we did last year, including the cap on developer fees that we put in last year, I believe will reverse that order once this is at maturity, so that the charities will be the number one beneficiary of charitable gambling. And I think that that is how it should be. There are two other policy changes related to charitable gaming in here, the most significant of which relates to how veterans organizations can use their charitable gambling dollars that they generate. It allows for a one-time 5-year period where organizations that are members of the Commander's Task Force, that's the 8 congressionally chartered veterans organizations such as the American Legion and the VFW, will be able to use up to 50% of their charitable gambling revenue to do capital improvements to their existing buildings. So this, in plain English, will allow American Legions to use up to half of their charitable gambling proceeds to make capital improvements to their posts. I think members are probably aware posts are closing around the state. They're under severe financial strain, and capital expenses are a significant problem for a lot of posts. Speaking for myself, the Coon Rapids American Legion closed several years ago, and it was devastating to our community to lose our post. And so the hope is that this will allow those valued institutions to stay open in Minnesota longer. We also included a couple provisions related to horse racing in the bill. First, we prohibit something that's called historical horse racing, which is just a euphemism for slot machines. They're not currently at the tracks, and we do not believe they should be at the tracks, notwithstanding certain racing commission actions the other night. We also created an economic development account at the Racing Commission and funded it to the tune of $625,000 a year. That money is to be used for purse supplements and is funded out of the tax on sports betting. Last, we reallocated the proceeds of the tax on sports betting. I already mentioned the charitable tax cuts and the Racing Commission funding. The appropriations to the agencies remain. We narrowed the scope of the special revenue fund to 20% of the total money that's generated from sports betting. The split inside that special revenue fund remains largely the same. In the Human Services Committee, we did add another component to the problem gaming money, and then we made a tweak in the State Government Committee to the amateur sports money, reserving some of the funds for non-athletic competitive sports. And that money, instead of going through the Amateur Sports Commission, now goes to the Minnesota State High School League, just because the Amateur Sports Commission has nothing to do with non-athletic competitive activities. So those are the changes that we made at a high level. There are other minor changes. I'm happy to answer members' questions.
Representative New Brindley. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Stevenson. A couple of questions. I get this, historical horse racing. You said that that's essentially slot machines. Isn't there some level of skill involved with the historical horse racing? This is not, the way that it's been explained to me, this is not what it is in Kentucky. And it sounds like in other states it really is. Totally chance. But here it is based on actual horse races that if you are able to follow, if you choose to do that, you actually can make informed decisions as much as any decision is an informed decision when it comes to gambling. And frankly, the very conservative racing commission, they saw it differently by a vote of 5-1. That was pretty significant that they view this differently. Why do you think that this is the same as slot machines? Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley, you don't have to take my word for it. I can give you a letter from the Alcohol Gambling Enforcement Division. They did a technical review of the proposal that was before the Racing Commission, and AGED at the staff level, not at a political level, concluded that the historical horse racing proposal that was considered by the Racing Commission was a gambling device, that it was not pari-mutuel racing, that it was a slot machine, designed as a slot machine, and they put that all in writing, and I'm very happy to provide you with that letter. I think that I don't know who's claiming that this is a game of skill, but I think that's a very questionable assertion. The way that historical horse racing goes is that you go up to a machine, you pick what horse you want to bet on without knowing what the race that you're betting on is. The computer randomly selects a race that you are betting on, and then if you picked the horse that won the random race that was selected, you win. I understand that there are people who believe that there is skill involved in the playing of slot machines, that they have a system, and so I guess it's possible that people will claim that historical horse racing is also a game that could require some skill, but this is a slot machine, and again, you don't have to take my word for it.
Representative New Brindley. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate that. I have the letter right here. I've reviewed the letter, and I've also reviewed the response to the letter that lays it out pretty clearly. And I understand really what this gets to is I get that we're trying to get something done here. It seems like this is a really easy way to help make these other organizations whole. And it still doesn't make them whole. We've seen significant losses in other states when we've opened up sports betting. They've seen significant losses in other states. I get that there's, an offering of some pennies in this bill to the tracks. $625,000 to be split between the tracks is not, that's literally couch cushion money here, right? That doesn't do anything to make anyone whole. And it seems like, if what we're trying to do is actually get this done, it seems like an odd mechanism to eliminate this entirely. And I would just also suggest, I'm just wondering, and Madam Chair, this would be another question, has there been any conversation, this is a new topic now, has there been any conversation on doing, obviously this is effectively, licenses are being given to the tribes. Has there been any conversation about doing profit sharing among the tribes? My understanding is also when this has been done in other states,
two or three vendors take up the vast majority of the market share, right? Like 80% of the market share. So does this leave some folks out of the profits if without a profit sharing mechanism? Is that another way to sort of get this done in a way that's fair to all the tribes? I mean, it seems like right now there's a real potential here for a windfall for some and for others to really be left out of the mix, which frankly we have seen even just in the casino market, right? That it's been really, really successful for a couple of tribes, a few tribes, and it's been less successful for others who don't have the foot traffic, who don't have the population centers, whatever. It's been much less successful. Have you considered that as a way to ensure some equity and fairness among the tribes to ensure that they're not left out by not being, you know, having one of those couple of vendors?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley, just first on the historical horse racing, I disagree strongly that it's an easy way to resolve the issue, and I just want to be very clear with folks, there is no universe in which any bill that leaves this committee is going to authorize historical horse racing at the tracks. That's a total non-starter, will not happen, will not be part of a sports betting deal. Bright red line in the sand. I think people who listen to me talk about sports betting over the last few years will know that I have talked about trying to find a deal and trying to find a compromise, and I've deliberately left many options on the table and not drawn many red lines. I'm drawing one right now. That will not happen. On the second question that you raised, I really am tickled to hear a Republican concerned about income disparities, and I think that it would be great if we continue that conversation and other methods. I will say that we're talking about sovereign governments here, and it's probably not appropriate for the state of Minnesota to be telling them what to do with their money.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Interesting take. On the one hand, we like equity and solving those disparities, but let's not touch this. Let's just let them fight it out. And also, I would just say, you know, this bill is not about authorizing the historical racing, horse racing. It's not about authorizing it. It's about preempting it. You are saying from the state level, we are going to prohibit it. And I hope you consider a similar bill for Uber and Lyft, because that's a much bigger deal for most of the state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Stevenson.
And I just want to be clear, this is a clarification. Historical horse racing in Minnesota is illegal. What the Racing Commission did last night, they broke two different laws. They did. And you have the letter from AGED, and let's be clear, the response you're talking about, I mean, you didn't identify what you're looking at. I'm guessing you're talking about a memo from a law firm that was hired by the tracks, which I don't, yes, the tracks say that their proposal is lawful. Surprise, surprise, sunrise, sunset. The nonpartisan regulator said that it breaks Minnesota law. It's a gambling device that is unauthorized under Minnesota law. The Racing Commission does not have the power authority to change that. We do. We are not. They also broke the law about not consulting with tribes before making a decision. We are going to clarify the law in this bill to make abundantly clear to a future Racing Commission that they do not have discretion to do this. But I will tell you that if we don't, I fully expect that the Racing Commission's decision will not survive judicial review.
Final follow-up,
Madam Chair. Thank you. I appreciate that. It's interesting the things that we pick and choose. It's interesting the things that we pick and choose. You know, you say the nonpartisan AGED. Well, I don't know. That's governor appointed, and frankly, so is the Racing Commission. You're right. It's not entirely governor. It is not entirely. But let's not pretend that these are non-political entities. Of course they are. And frankly, the Racing Commission is entirely appointed by Democrat governors. Like, to pretend that one is virtuous and one is not, come on, like, what are we doing here?
Representative Schultz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to kind of follow up along the exchange just a moment ago in regards to the interaction with the Native American tribes, especially because we looked at a bill last week in regards to marijuana, specifically laying out the tribes in it. There's additional definitions found in bills passed last year that specifically allocated the equity measures. And so to Representative New Brindley's point, I would kind of love to hear a little bit more about what the protections that you would consider, Representative Stevenson, to ensure that it's not benefiting one over another, considering that there is such a limitation on the current vendors operating in this space.
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, it's interesting that you bring up the cannabis bill as an example, because that is an example of how tribes are different. They are sovereign entities. The cannabis bill that we passed into law last year says that the relationship between the tribes and the state with regard to cannabis will be decided by compact, sovereign nation to sovereign nation. We do not dictate how cannabis is regulated on tribal lands, and in fact we're seeing different tribes do different things on that score. These are sovereign nations, and that's exactly what I was saying to Representative New Brindley a minute ago, which is that we don't get to tell them how to spend their money. They are sovereign nations. So I actually think that there's a parallel there. The bills that we considered last week, to my knowledge, don't change that.
Follow up, Representative Schultz.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. No, I think this is super interesting, right? If there's only a few vendors that do this work, in essence, they will have to contract with one or two, or each different vendor may have to contract with an individual tribe. And so that is where the discrepancy could exist, and why we brought this up as a talking point, because there might be, as an example, there might be a Native American tribe that literally doesn't have the ability to compete in the same way that a larger tribe does, and so what sort of safeguards should be considered from the state of Minnesota in order to ensure that equity?
Chair Stevenson.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, number one, I think that if you look to other states, you will find that there's enough vendors out there that if all 11 tribes in Minnesota chose to partner with a vendor and offer this product, they would be able to do so. I don't say that to contradict the thrust of your point. You said that there's maybe only a couple of vendors, and I just want to be clear that there are almost certainly enough vendors. What is important, where I think there's validity to what you were saying, is that not all vendors are created equal, right? And there's only a handful that control a very large segment of the market share, right? Mm-hmm. But that doesn't counteract what I've been saying all along, which is that these are sovereign nations that we're talking about. And by the way, there are many tribes of those 11, and members will know that I've been carrying this bill for 3 years now. I've made at least 3 full circuits and visited with all 11 3 times. And there are many of them that have no intention of getting involved in sports betting, legal or not. They don't want to do it. And that's fine. That's their choice. They're sovereign nations. But it's not for us to tell them how to spend their money or share their money or not share their money.
Representative Schultz.
Yeah, thank you. And Representative Stevenson, appreciate what you said and the interactions that you're having with those sovereign tribes in Minnesota. But yes, and I'm going to kind of understate this for the record. You know, there are a couple, as in 2 or 3 vendors that carry, 70% of the market share on this, plus or minus, meaning if a smaller tribe doesn't have the ability to compete like a larger tribe, that quite honestly could mean that they don't have the ability to create a meaningful benefit to their community. So I'll just note that. And then I did have an additional, and then, you know, it was the bill that I referenced from last year was the tax bill. The tax bill that provided $35 million, and it was allocated to each of the Ojibwe tribes in Minnesota, 7 of them. Each receiving $5 million from the state of Minnesota, almost in direct payments to them. And so I just wanted to point that out, that also happened last year in something where it was, at least in the case of the Ojibwe tribes, not necessarily the Dakota tribes, it was equal amidst those 7 Ojibwe tribes. Next question that I have is, as you consider, you know, the same topic that we've been on, Representative Stevenson, if this preemption or prohibition, I guess, in a sense, were to go into place following what Representative New Brindley was talking about, isn't that going to significantly impact, you know, agriculture in general, if we're going to be impacting, you know, kind of the horse racing space? And could that have negative impacts for a very large section of our economy?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, I just want to briefly touch on what you were just talking about with the tribal aid bill. Just to be very clear, the tribal aid bill that passed last year, number one, was authorized tribal aid to all 11 tribes in Minnesota. Some of the Dakota tribes are declining to participate in that. At least one is participating, to my knowledge. Their tribal count, when I visited with them earlier this year, they told me that they were. There may be others. And also, you said an equal amounts to each tribe. That's inaccurate. Part of it was a flat fee, and then it's, part of it's based on enrollment numbers. But that's splitting hairs. I just want to correct the record. On historic horse racing, this is not happening currently. Okay? It is. There are no slot machines at the tracks, and there's not going to be slot machines at the tracks. If we clarify the law to make clear that slot machines can't be on the tracks, is that going to have a negative impact on agriculture in Minnesota? No, because there isn't currently slot machines at the tracks. There, I know, as Representative New Brindley made the argument, that some people argue that if we legalize sports betting, it will have a negative impact on the tracks. And I believe the evidence for that is to look to other states where we've seen a decline. What I would note is that horse racing in Minnesota and elsewhere is in decline generally. Whether or not sports betting has an impact on that is a matter of some debate, but prohibiting something that isn't currently happening in Minnesota, and as I said a minute ago, I believe is unlawful in Minnesota, even after being approved by the Racing Commission the other night, is not going to negatively impact agriculture in Minnesota.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Stevenson, you said something that I think is really important just to highlight. When we are talking about the sovereign nations, the tribal Native American communities in Minnesota, you stated that you've made three circuits to talk with them. And I think it's really important that we highlight the fact that you're not speaking for them, but you've incorporated their wants, their desires, and their needs in this bill. Is that correct?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Cleburne, that is correct. And I'll just add as an aside that I know a lot of other members have been visiting tribal nations. I think that's really wonderful. And I would encourage anyone who hasn't done so to do that and to visit more than one, to visit different parts of the state. Frankly, one of the best things I've taken away from carrying this bill has been the knowledge that as someone who grew up in Minnesota, lived here my whole life, I knew embarrassingly little about our tribal nations before carrying this bill, and everybody should take a chance to go out and talk to folks.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Stevenson. There are a couple of provisions in this that I think are pretty good in terms of helping out our charities. Two big picture points about that. I wish that, you know, instead of handing the, you know, crippling the charities first and then handing them a crutch, that we hadn't done that in the first place. It's frustrating to me that this stuff is all, that helping out our charities is all sort of tied up or held hostage to a bigger deal on sports betting. But there are a couple of provisions here. You know, the charity tax cuts, that's a good thing. We should be able to do that independent of sports betting. I wish we were able to. The provision about VFWs and American Legions, that's a good provision. I wish we were able to do that independently. I wish it didn't have to be held hostage to, you know, doing this other stuff on sports betting. But I did want to call out that there are a couple of good provisions that I hope do pass, whether as part of this or independently. So, thank you.
Representative Tabke.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Chair Stevenson, for all your work on this bill. I wanted to piggyback on what Representative Schultz said and invite him to work together on helping to figure this out. We have I am lucky in my district to both represent Canterbury Park and the SMSC community in Shakopee, and so having both of those perspectives and things going on is really, really important in my community that both of these are successful and moving forward. And with that, we have a lot to understand and a lot going forward. It is, we've been really clear, especially with Canterbury Park, that historical horse racing is not something that is legal in Minnesota and something that cannot move forward. And so we'll continue working on ways to make sure. And I love to disagree with Chair Stevenson on things. It always makes my life more fun when I can do that. But I do believe that sports betting bill passing will have a negative impact on Canterbury Park, and we need to make sure that that is taken into consideration and discussed and figured out as it's moving forward. And we're still, I just thank Chair Stevenson and everybody for working together on figuring this out as we move forward to make sure that this is best thing for all Minnesotans and making sure that we're going forward. So I just want to make sure that that was there and on the record, and that we're keeping continuing to work on that, and I have confidence we'll get there.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the bill author, we talk about the fact that the tribal nations are sovereign nations and certainly understand and respect that. The question that I have is, even though those sovereign nations are individual sovereign nations, they would not have the ability to do sports betting and gaming without authorization in from your bill. Is that correct?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, you intended that to be a simple question. It's actually very complicated. It depends on where you're talking about. So what this bill authorizes is mobile sports betting and across the state, and compacting between state and tribes with regard to on-reservation brick-and-mortar sports betting. So with regard to the mobile sports betting that would be operated by the tribes in partnership with operators off reservation, absolutely you are correct. They could not do that without action by the legislature. With regard to the on-reservation gambling, I think that that is a really difficult question. The bill authorizes compacting between the state and the tribes. Whether they could initiate that on their own without legislative action, I'm not an expert on IGRA, the federal law that governs these types of relationships. I know it was when I was first looking at this bill 3 years ago, there were voices in tribal communities that I visited that said, we don't need a bill. We'll just do this on reservation lands and compact. And that has been the approach that other states, including Wisconsin, have taken, where I don't believe there was a law passed. I believe they just compacted. And the only thing that they allow is on-reservation gaming. Because the important thing to understand is that tribes of sovereign nation, they have the right to engage in gambling, before the state of Minnesota existed. And it's not something that we gave them. It's something that was recognized and figured out through the compacts, but it's a right of a sovereign nation to decide for themselves.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, and however we want to, whichever component we want to look at on this, to provide authorizing or enabling legislation that's before the committee in an informational component today, we would still have the ability to negotiate, would we not, with the tribes on some things that we thought were important as Minnesotans. And I'm going to go back to the comment that Representative Brindley made and then the comment that you made to her comment, and that was, I'm surprised to hear and pleased to hear that Republicans are concerned about equity. And if we were concerned about equity, could we not put something in the enabling legislation that says, if you choose not to get involved, that's fine. If you choose to get involved, here's how we're going to do that. And here's why I say that. There are players out there that are going to take 70% of the business, and it's no different than any other industry. If you happen to be Uber and Lyft, you're going to go to Minneapolis and St. Paul because that's where the people are. That's where the rides are. You get the rest of the state of Minnesota because it's part of a package deal. And I see this very much similar to what happens when you talk about the tribe that is in and the sovereign nation that Representative Tabke represents, quite successful. As a matter of fact, the largest tribal enterprise in the state of Minnesota or within the geographic boundaries of the state of Minnesota. And we have a lot of them that scale in size from there. If we want to take care of equity on here, could we not put something that says, if you want to enter into this, here is the formula that you would engage in as the state enabling this off, use the term off-campus betting that this bill authorizes. Why would we not enter into an agreement that would do that equity to try to help the nations that would be negatively impacted by revenues that would not be coming simply by the fact that the bigger players are going to go to the bigger markets? Again, just like we see with Uber and Lyft. Uber and Lyft leave Minnesota. Yeah, it's not a big market compared to the nation, compared to the world where they do business. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll. You know, first thing I just point out is that because sports betting is not reliant on mobile sports betting is not reliant on the license holder being geographically close to a population center the same way that traditional casino gambling is, which is why the comments that you made about the Shakopee Mattawakan Sioux Committee are accurate. I mean, it's entirely possible that one of these large operators that we're talking about chooses to partner with a tribe that is not close to the metro. You know, that's entirely possible, and I frankly think it very easily could happen. I think it will be about proactive negotiation and not as preordained as I think people are saying. The question about the question that Representative Brindley raised earlier, I didn't understand that to be a could. It is like, why aren't we doing this? And I said, I don't believe it's our place to tell tribes, sovereign tribes, how to spend their money. Could we do that in law for the mobile sports betting? I mean, I don't see why we could not do that. I don't believe we should do that. And I think that if you look at the long history of how the state of Minnesota has interacted with tribal nations, I think that the respect for sovereignty is a more recent phenomena and something that we should be extra cautious about. I think respecting sovereign tribal sovereignty means not telling them how to spend their money.
Any follow-up, Representative Driscoll?
Thank you. Again, the overriding point on this for me is that there are going to be, once again, winners and losers that are chosen in here. And I've been in this legislature long enough to know that with different sovereign nations coming before talking about the disparities that they see compared to their peers and the impoverishment and things that they have to deal with and putting resources in place and medical and clinics and all things we talk about here in front of the Commerce Committee for the people of the state of Minnesota, they need to deal with and try to deal with. I'm just saying, is there a way that we can help all tribal nations be on an equal footing through the legislation that we have here in the state of Minnesota? And we also have, no pun intended, a horse in that race as the state of Minnesota because we also help support the needs as Minnesotans, because they're Minnesotans as well, to be able to try to help them. Because that is what I was hearing back in the 90s, that the tribes that are close to where I live wanted to be able to have the ability to be able to support themselves. They simply wanted to have the ability to have the resources. So I'm wondering if we're not just selling ourselves short, but not trying to anticipate something like that at some for a future need that may arise. Thank you, Madam Chair. There's really no question there. It's just kind of a summation.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. Chair Stevenson, if you want to respond to that and move into final comments.
Yeah, I'll just go to closing comments. I appreciate the good discussion today and the questions, and always appreciate the committee's input. Always happy to continue those conversations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that will conclude our informational hearing on House File 2000. And the chair has to run to another committee. Members, the next item on our agenda today is House File 4220 from Representative Lee. I will move that House File 4220 be laid over, and I will also move a DE1 amendment for Representative Lee to get the bill in the shape that she would like. Members, any question before we vote on the DE1, and then we'll let her talk to the bill as amended. All right. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the DE1 amendment is adopted. Representative Lee, to your bill as amended.
Great. Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. I really appreciate the time to present House File 4220 in front of members today. As some of you may know, in 2019, the legislature passed an historic assisted living licensure law, which made Minnesota the very last state in this country to license assisted living settings. The law gave residents critical consumer protections with, however, two exempted settings. The first is facilities receiving money from HUD for housing, and the second is facilities that received LIHTC or low-income housing tax credits. And note that both of these settings provide same or similar services, but were still exempted in 2019. Initially, the concern for the exemption was that federal funding may be jeopardized if forced to be licensed. However, a report in June 2022 by DHS workgroups showed that residents in these exempted settings receive less protections than those in assisted living. Most notably, the workgroup found that there's no legal reason why residents in these two settings should not receive the same or similar consumer protections as their peers in assisted living. So I really hope we also talk about addressing disparities, because this is a really stark disparity in the way that we treat our seniors and folks who live in assisted living in Minnesota. And we've seen that this disparity has led to real consequences. Last July, dozens of residents living in a LIHTC facility in Bemidji were forced to leave a dangerous building. However, there was no obligation on the provider to assist those residents to find a new and safe place to live. In your packets is a letter from Lisa Papp Richards, a volunteer who helped relocate some of those residents, who describes the chaotic aftermath. Vulnerable adults without any safe places to go and no clear plan or path to enforce, appeal, or challenge what happened to them. Now, this bill fixes the current parity issue by providing residents in HUD and LIHTC similar protections, such as freedom from retaliation, freedom from arbitrary discharge, due process, and appeal rights upon termination of the facility. And we also want to note that this is the second stop for this bill, and so we continue to engage with members of the provider community and believe that this second DE that we adopted today addresses some of those concerns. This bill is something that will continue to be worked on. But I just want to close before I turn over to my testifier that what we cannot have is an unfair system where residents of facilities subsidized by the federal government continue to have fewer rights than those living in private assisted living settings. And now I'm going to turn it over to my testifier.
First, we have Sean Burke. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and thank you, Representative Lee, for bringing this bill. My name is Sean Burke. I'm with O'Connell Consulting here on behalf of the Minnesota Elder Justice Center and speaking on behalf of a coalition of resident and consumer advocates. Our letter is also in your packet that includes AARP, Legal Aid, Elder Justice Center, the Ombudsman Offices for Long-Term Care, and Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and the Alzheimer's Association. So I do want to take just a couple of minutes to briefly explain the genesis of this bill and why it's in front of the Commerce Committee, and then I'll talk a little bit deeper about the protections in the DE. As Representative Lee noted, in 2019, we passed a landmark assisted living licensure law. We were the last state of the union to license assisted living. Before that, we had a regulatory scheme that really wasn't regulatory. It was called Housing with Services, where those facilities would register with the Department of Health, but there really wasn't anyone overseeing the combination of housing and services. So we had a huge gap. If you're a resident advocate and you're trying to help someone and their services are terminated, that person lost their housing. If their housing was terminated, they lost their services. It was a big deal. It was incredibly confusing. And so in the assisted living law that passed, it changed that scheme. Now residents all across Minnesota who live in assisted living have significant and robust consumer protections, especially when it comes to the termination and discharge of their housing or services. Now, when that bill was passed, HUD which funds the facilities that we're talking about today, expressed some concerns that HUD regulations would be in conflict with licensure. And so rather than deal with those issues, the HUD facilities and the low-income housing tax credit facilities were exempted out. So that's why you hear this term, exempt settings. In 2021, in order to not lose the very baseline protections in those exempt settings that we had in Housing with Services, 325F.722, a consumer protection statute, was passed by this by the legislature. This is current law. It provides very bare minimum consumer protections to those that live in these exempt settings. But right now, the difference between those residents and the residents who live in private assisted living is really stark. 325F.722 is not a regulatory scheme. MDH and DHS do not enforce it. The Department of Commerce does not enforce it. As it stands, it does not provide enough protection to these residents. And the letters in your packet that Representative Lee referred to really highlight why that is. We have one example where a woman with dementia in one of these settings was given 10-day notice to leave, no help to leave, and her granddaughter is left holding the bag of figuring out where she has to go. If that person was living in a private assisted living, she'd have had all sorts of discharge protections with that notice. We'll talk about that in just a second. So the underlying bill sought to really bring residents in these exempt settings to parity with their peers who live in private assisted living, simply by beefing up these protections in 325F.722. Okay, so that brings us to the DE. And the DE is a result of our consumer coalition listening to providers and to HUD and to responding to the issues and concerns that they raised. So quickly through the DE, Section 1 clarifies that if a setting is holding itself out as assisted living, it needs to be licensed as an assisted living. This is a common sense clarification, and HUD has suggested we add sections 2 through 4 so that any HUD setting that does become licensed, their regulations do not conflict with HUD. Sections 5 through 7 simply make some technical changes in other parts of the statute to conform with this bill. And then the rest of the DE, sections 8 through 18, these apply to these other exempt settings that are never going to be assisted living licensed. It enhances the current protections that we've been talking about, 325F.722. Really what it does is provide for stronger discharge protections and an appeal right to an administrative law judge. Again, it puts these residents on the same footing as their peers in AL. I would draw you to the core protections, which are in sections 12 through 15. Taken together, they require exempt setting service provider or an exempt setting housing provider to follow the same process, not to become an AL, but simply follow the same process as an assisted living provider when it comes to a termination. It allows residents to appeal to an administrative law judge if they disagree with that termination. If a resident does have to move because they lose the appeal or they lose in housing court, there is no obligation on the provider right now to help that they find a safe place to live. This would change that and require a coordination between the housing and service provider and the resident. And it provides some protections for residents in case a setting has to close, similar to the Bemidji case. So finally, as I close, how is this DE different than the underlying bill? Well, as I mentioned, it does reflect ongoing conversations with the provider community and with HUD. The biggest and most significant change is that it narrows these protections to only apply to people receiving services in these settings. It also clarifies that these providers can continue to use two contracts, a housing provider and a service provider. So unlike regular assisted living or licensed assisted living where there's one entity, this allows two entities to continue to exist. And then it cleans up some language around assisted living. The statute does cross-reference 144G, our assisted living statute, but that is simply to lay out the process and the rights that residents have. It's in no way to oblige an exempt setting to become licensed or to follow those regulations or to be regulated, again, by MDH, DHS, or the Commerce Department. So in sum, what this bill does is bring some urgently needed discharge protections and parity to residents who are in similar situations as their AL peers. We appreciate your time, and I can stand for any questions.
All right. We do have a couple of people who signed up to testify. First is Angela Guerin. you just come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony, and welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Angela Guerin with Care Providers of Minnesota, here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. To start, we do recognize that the DE amendment attempts to address many concerns that we have raised with Representative Lee and the advocates. However, we just received the amendment yesterday when it was posted to committee, so we're still working to collect feedback from our members about the amendment's impact, just to ensure that the exempt settings are able to continue to offer critical services and housing to seniors and other Minnesotans. Exempt settings provide specialized services for low-income Minnesotans, particularly individuals with mental illness, behavioral health challenges, and substance use disorders. These exempt settings are providers who often fill a critical need in their community, serving individuals who would otherwise face homelessness or admission to a hospital or a higher acuity setting. From the feedback we've received from our providers so far, we do appreciate that the amendment does appear to only apply to residents receiving services and that it eliminates the requirement to seek an assisted living licensure for most exempt settings. We also appreciate efforts to clarify the use of HUD or housing contract separate from service contracts. If you don't mind, I will turn it over to my colleague to continue our testimony.
We also did have Aaron Hupert, who I'm assuming is the colleague. So, Ms. Hupert, if you want to come forward and state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Aaron Hupert, here with Leading Age Minnesota, here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative as well. So as my colleague started, we have a few continued concerns that we just wanted to state for the record. We appreciate the changes with respect to contract termination and coordinated moves. However, we're not sure how it will be operationalized in some circumstances. So, for example, if HUD as a federal program requires termination of a contract for violation of drug policy on premises, and another location won't take the resident, we're not sure how the provider is supposed to give a coordinated move as required under this bill. In reality, the provider will likely be stuck between a statutory rock under this bill and then another rock under federal requirements without a source of payment. More broadly, and I understand and respect that this is beyond the purview of the Commerce Committee, contract termination, relocation, and coordinated moves within assisted living are challenging for many assisted living providers today, and the Long-Term Care Imperative would be remiss if we supported expanding that framework to other providers. So we can very much respect the advocate's position to ensure strong consumer protections, but we also have to recognize that the quality, health, and safety of other residents and staff are being compromised with increasing frequency. And so perhaps the right step forward is to address some of those more complicated and nuanced issues over the interim, where we can have some benefit of time, thoughtfulness, and purpose. Finally, since this bill was heard in the previous committee, we would just note that separate legislation has been introduced and is moving forward through this process that will make some additional title protection changes for assisted living. Those changes would be effective January 1st, 2026. So as this bill moves forward, and it should become law this year, we're hoping that there is some opportunity for consideration of alignment since the effective dates of this bill are January 1st, 2025.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, member discussion to the bill. Representative Cleborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to thank Representative Lee for bringing the bill forward. This is a really complicated issue, as we've just heard. And there is nothing more terrifying to a person in early stages of dementia or in a vulnerable state than to lose their housing. And the situation in Bemidji was terrible. A lot of families were impacted at that time. We also have more seniors living solo. So the question that I would have, and maybe this is for your testifier, is that, and forgive me for not, it's been a long time since I've read the assisted list, assisted living licensure booklet. So would the Office of the Ombudsman be the place for individuals to go for assistance, or where would they, where would be their first call for help?
Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Claiborne, yes, that is a great point. The Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care currently operates in assisted living, and they are added to this statute as well to clarify that if a discharge notice is provided, that the individual receives that information about that office. And then oftentimes that ombudsman's office, they become the advocate in this process. I'll also add the other ombudsman's office for mental health and developmental disabilities largely serves in this is a generalization, but serves younger population, but are also in assisted living and these exempt settings. They're also a part of the coalition and also part of this bill. So both of those offices would be notified, and those notifications are key. Otherwise, oftentimes the public doesn't find out about these issues. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up. The other statement that I would like to make is, when these eviction notices come, they come without any option, as your bill is trying to address. And the only place some of the individuals who are being evicted have to go is to a homeless shelter. So it is not that we can't address the complexity of getting them into assisted other housing, but we have to address that. I think I'm not making myself very clear, but there is a need for us to have a plan for individuals who don't have adequate housing. And if they have a complex chemical or mental health need, just releasing them to a homeless shelter is not sufficient to care for Minnesotans. I think that's the message I would like to get out there. So thank you for the legislation.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lee. In fact, I know Ms. Richards very well, and I followed the story, and it was really a difficult situation. However, I do share Ms. Huppert's concern, particularly, you know, with the statutory requirement to move people. My concern is also that that rock and hard place also involves the fact that sometimes there is not another place, which creates issues. However, my question for you is actually the bill language. I'm looking on page 5 under your definitions. Line 5.26 talks about definitions and says, unless the context clearly indicates otherwise. That's a little bit of unusual language to see in statute. So I'm wondering if you can give us an example of when context might change a statutory definition.
And I see Mr. Elwood's coming up. I know, Representative Lee, if you want to speak to that, and then we can hear from Mr. Elwood as well.
Or... Yeah, sure. Thank you, Chair. I think, so this is the culmination of us trying to workshop and compromise language because we are borrowing from 144G. And so I am not a lawyer. And so the technical piece I'm going to leave to Mr. Elwood from Legal Aid. But as we said, this is a work in progress with just trying to legislate for this kind of unique situation.
Mr. Elwood, if you could state your name for the record and then answer the question.
Mr. Chair, members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and thank you, Representative Lee, for this bill. And thanks for the question. I actually asked the same question because counsel had added that. And it's the reason is because there's one section in there refers to the right of a resident to get home care from a separate home care provider. And so the home care, all the home care industry is not included in this bill. It's not subject to any of these requirements. And so that's where that language, that's what that language is specifically intended to do, is to clarify that home care folks aren't included.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that clarification. We might want to deal with that differently and clarify the language about home care rather than this very broad, unless context clearly indicates otherwise, because I'm not sure that's always clear. So that may be something to work on moving forward. I have a sort of a question, and I don't know that it interacts with this at all, but I just want to understand if it would interact. You know, my father-in-law was in an assisted living situation, and he had some pretty significant behavior issues. It was very legitimate, and he was required by the assisted living facility. They took him to the hospital, and they would not let him come back until he had an inpatient geriatric psych evaluation, which is very difficult to get. He spent a number of days in the ER and then in a unit, which, frankly, it was appropriate in this situation, right? He was diabetic. They were giving him shots. He was trying to take his needles and stab. I mean, it was a really appropriate situation for him, actually, to pull him out and require additional treatment before he would be allowed back into the facility. Would this affect that kind of situation at all?
Representative Lee.
So I think, yeah, I'm going to defer to Mr. Burke, because I think the details are important on what kind of facility that was, actually.
Mr. Burke. Mr. Chair, Representative New Brindley, it's a fantastic example, not because of the situation, but because it was something we contemplated as a big we when writing the 2019 bill. And so in current assisted living statute 144G, it contemplates a situation just like this, where someone has acute needs, they need to be moved out of the housing, maybe temporarily, maybe permanently. From the resident advocate's perspective, the situation that we really want to make sure is that if your father-in-law had recovered or got better, or it was maybe more temporary than what you're describing, that he would have the right to return. And if the assisted living facility felt like they could no longer care for his needs, that they would need to issue the due process protections like they would anyone else. And so they'd have to still terminate him and not just say, well, you're in a hospital now, so you can't come back. When we had that housing with services law before assisted living licensure, that would happen all the time. People would be moved or leave for an acute issue, maybe significant, maybe not so significant, and then said, sorry, you can't come back, you left. And that's essentially an illegal lockout, but those cases are very difficult to litigate and to prove. And so the protections in 144G passed in 2019 explicitly cover those situations. We are adopting that protection in this situation as well, because it's so critical for people who may want to return home if they do get better.
Mm-hmm. One more follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I'm not totally clear then on whether or not, I mean, like I said, he really was dangerous. It was appropriate to make these requirements. So is the assisted living facility, are they allowed to put parameters in place on whether that person can return? So for example, with my father-in-law, they said that he could not return unless he was being treated for his behaviors. And again, his behaviors were dangerous. I mean, he was taking needles and stabbing staff. I mean, it really was problematic. So would this allow, or does this put the assisted living facility in a place where they are now required to deal with him beyond what they are capable of doing?
Representative Lee?
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative New Brindley. So I just want to clarify, this legislation is only for HUD and LIHTC facilities and, like, not facilities that fall under 144G. But given these, like, circumstances and the details, those considerations would be taken into place with the administrative law judge. So it's not saying, like, you know, we're not barring a negotiation process, right? We're just trying to create a due process system where you know, your father-in-law or a patient in a similar situation would not be at a disadvantage. I think something that, you know, we haven't highlighted a lot in this discussion is these folks in HUD and LIHTC facilities are probably some of the most vulnerable adults we have in Minnesota who are low income, who, you know, would be at a disadvantage in our housing court system, right? And so, it's creating this due process system where a provider or you know the patient would be equally represented. I hope that answers your question.
One very little follow-up, Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do appreciate that. I would just suggest that it shouldn't matter what kind of facility it is. Like, I mean, if those behaviors are dangerous and he needs to be treated for those behaviors, it doesn't really matter what kind of facility it is. He needs that treatment. So I would think about that. And I guess my follow-up question would be then, I mean, there are still clearly some question marks, concerns. You have indicated a couple of times that you are going to continue to engage. I just want some confirmation that we'll just, this, will you continue to engage with all the stakeholders moving forward before this is a done deal?
Representative Lee.
Yep, this is absolutely a work in progress.
Thank all you, right. Mr. Chair.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lee, for bringing the bill forward. You really are working on an area that's sort of an intractable situation where things stand now, but you have, as was mentioned, vulnerable adults that really need a resolution to this. So thank you for your work on that area. I was just, when we were talking about the number of ombudsmen we have, how many are there and what's the scope of this problem? Are we talking hundreds of cases or thousands of cases? Where are we at here in Minnesota?
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Berg has the most up-to-date stats on this, but our hope is to also alleviate some of their workload from our discussions that we've had. So,
Mr. Berg.
Chair Stevenson, Representative Bierman, there is a representative from the Ombudsman's Office who could speak to very specific numbers of their organization. I will say back when the law was passed in 2019, we were the worst state. Actually worse than the worst state. I think we ranked 52nd in terms of ombudsman funded per resident in our state. We've funded that better, so we're like in the 30s now, something like that. So we're getting better, but we're still not to where we need to be. And then in terms of how many cases generally are we talking about, the exempt settings, there's dozens and dozens and dozens of them. If you add in some of the LIHTC facilities, maybe we're talking about a couple of hundred. The current administrative law judge has noted that in the last 2 years that we've had this regulatory scheme, there's been about between 100 and 150 discharge appeals filed. That's for about 2,000 private assisted living. So you scale that down to the couple of hundred of exempt settings, and we're talking maybe a couple of dozen appeals. That's just a really rough guess. So the workload probably can be absorbed by the Ombudsman's Office. I do not want to speak for them. Mm-hmm. If you want more testimony from their office, they're here as well.
And I did see someone walking down, perhaps from the Ombudsman's Office. So I don't know if you just state your name for the record and then give an answer to Representative Bierman's question.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. My name is Pari J. Rudina, Legislative Specialist with the Office of Ombudsman for Long-Term Care. We currently already work in these settings, so we are supporting residents who call us and are having challenges. I think our support for this bill is to be able to have more tools with which to be able to support those residents, but we are already there.
Any Representative
Bierman? No.
Okay. Okay. Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I can add anything new to the conversation, but I would appreciate, because the questions I had start out with the stuff that Representative Cleavorn was talking about, and then Representative Brindley expanded on, familiar as well with individuals who have had challenges with behavior and dementia progressing, and the facility has requested that there be an off-site evaluation, and then as soon as that off-site evaluation begins, you're not welcome back, and trying to find a place. As Representative Cleavorn said, they may end up in a homeless shelter. Fortunately, the cases I know didn't, but unfortunately they were miles and miles and miles away from environments and loved ones who could come and visit and be with them. So this is not a problem that's anywhere near the end of resolution. As our society continues to age, we're at the front end of this and not at the back end of this as a societal issue. So I appreciate the work that you're doing. And as you pointed out, there's still some work that needs to be done. And I also realize that we're talking about this in the context of HUD, but it's global.
Closing comments, Representative Lee.
Great. Thank you, Chair. I appreciate the robust discussion here, and want to just note that there are a lot of members here who are working on a senior task force, and just with the understanding that we have an aging population here in both Minnesota and across the country, and so this is just like a very, very small piece of this growing problem. So I would appreciate the discussion on this piece of the bill, and look forward to working with all of the partners going forward.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lee. And with that, House File 4220, as amended, is laid over. The final item on our agenda today is House File 4587. I move House File 4587 be laid over. And Representative Bierman, once you are situated, you may describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, thanks for hearing House File 4587. This is a bill to improve driver safety for those of us 50 and older. This bill changes the rules governing driver safety courses to reduce the length of the first-time course from 8 hours to 4 hours to be eligible for Minnesota's auto insurance discount without compromising the quality of the content. Drivers will still be required to take the 4-hour refresher course within 3 years to continue to qualify for the discount. This change will encourage more older adults to take these courses, as participation numbers have declined in states requiring 8-hour courses. The AARP has seen a decline of 27% in the last few years. Survey data shows participants are overwhelmingly positive about the course, except for the 8 hours. Members, with traffic deaths on the rise for older Minnesotans, fatal crashes have increased from 34.5% to 39.2% for the age group of 55 and above. And traffic congestion at an all-time high, one way to keep older drivers on the road safely is to maintain their driving skills through education. An independent study conducted by the AARP comparing the 4-hour refresher course and 8-hour courses found that course length had no significant impact on the amount of knowledge drivers retained, and drivers were equally as likely to change 19 safe driving behaviors for the better. As the number of older drivers increases, it is important for residents to get the information they need to be safer on our roads and to educate them on changes to roadways such as roundabouts, J-turns, and updates to driving laws. Members, currently 18 states allow a course length of 4 hours, and 9 states already mandate insurance discounts for 4-hour courses. Mr. Chair, everybody in red behind me would like to speak today, but we're going to just have one instead. So when you're ready, Ms. Salo would like to come forward, and then we can hear from members, please.
That sounds like a bargain I cannot pass up. So we'll start, Ms. Salo, if you'd come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chairman Stevenson and members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Salo, and I've been an AARP volunteer instructor for 10 years, and I'm in my 5th year as the AARP Driver Safety State Coordinator. I'm here in support of HF 4587, a bill that reduces the 8-hour driver safety course to 4 hours, and would like to thank Representative Bierman for bringing this bill forward. Since 2018, AARP Driver Safety has helped 59,000 Minnesota drivers be safer on our roads. However, as Representative Bierman said, our participation per course has dropped since 2019. And as we've seen with the increase in fatalities for older driving population, we should do better and we can do better by reducing the 8-hour requirement to 4 hours for first-time attendees. Encouraging safe driving practices is our number one priority while teaching, but with time constraints on everyone's schedules, it's difficult to convince drivers to take the initial 8-hour course, even with the 10% auto insurance discount. Did you know in 1 mile of driving, we make 150 driving decisions? AARP driver safety courses aid in that decision making by discussing change and our willingness to accept change as we age and continue driving. We provide a participant manual for each attendee. We show 19 videos to back up our state-approved curriculum, and we take time to discuss Minnesota driving laws. This still leaves time in a four-hour course for Q&A and participant interaction. I hope this gives you a picture of the value and need to reduce the eight-hour requirement to 4 hours so more older Minnesotans will participate so we can all be safer on our roads. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, member discussion to the bill. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like this. I think overall this is a good idea, but I will yield my time to Representative O'Driscoll because I think he has some firsthand experience.
Whoa, Representative O'Driscoll.
I perked the other side of the table up pretty quickly. As someone who has had experience in taking these classes, I think is what Representative New Brindley was referencing, and on more than one occasion, not because I failed the first time, but I graduated and it was time to renew that opportunity. I love the program. It's a great program. Couple of things on here. Number one, initially when I heard, oh, we're going to drop this from 8 hours to 4 hours, I thought, great idea. And then I thought, okay, some drivers probably need the 8 hours. If you've been on the road, some drivers need 12 or 14 hours of training because of their driving habits and the like. But I think that if it's a four-hour course, you're going to have more people, as we've talked about, participate in this than having it be an eight-hour or a 12-hour course, because then you feel like you're back in school on this. I do have one question, and I don't know who can answer this, but there may be a fiscal cost to this, to the state of Minnesota, from the standpoint that the Minnesota Highway Safety Research Center puts together an online video program that you can purchase. I don't know what the cost of that is going to be, if anything, to reset that eight-hour course into the four-hour course, because the four-hour refresher course is really a subset, because I've taken both of them, so it's like, hey, I remember that video on there. So I'm just wondering if we're going to be every 3 years running the same four-hour video versus the expanded, or there's going to be a new four-hour and then a follow-up four-hour that might be slightly different than the original new four-hour program.
And I'll turn over to Representative Veerman, but I will say that Ms. Eng communicated to me through nonverbal communication here that there has been a fiscal note on the bill and that it shows no cost to the state. Representative Veerman.
I think my testifier has something to add as well on that.
Ms. Saylor.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. We do charge a fee, of course, but every about 5 or 6 years, we do change our curriculum slightly. We did that 2 years ago. Pretty much consistently, we do still talk about change. We added a few new things. The pricing structure for the in-person courses is $20 for AARP members, $25 for non-members. The online course is somewhat higher than that. From what I understand, our current online course, which is managed by a third-party vendor, not AARP, is still the older curriculum, and they do not have the opportunity of sharing the state-specific information as we do in the in-person classes.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Just a closing comment. I did observe the chair get the communication in a nonverbal way from staff. And just for clarification, it is no how a nonverbal communication that I have seen on highways from one driver to another from time to time.
Appreciate the clarification. Yeah, I would never do that here. Representative Veerman.
In closing, just thank you for hearing the bill. Glad we were able to get it done, and I hope all of you who can take part in this will do so. I have 11 siblings, and 5 of them have done this course repeatedly, so good course. And talked to my agent the other day. He says he talks about this almost every day with his clients. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Representative Veerman. And the course is available to people ages 55 and older, so I will look forward to taking it in 30 years. And with that, the bill is laid over. And there's nothing further on the agenda for today, so we will adjourn.